Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Jim Jordan, Philadelphia chapter president of the American Composers Forum. Jason Pfeiffer examines the nuances of funding nonprofit theater. We'll hear how the Wilma Theater, People's Light and Theater Company, and Theater Exile pay their bills. We speak with Hazami Sayed, the founder and president of Al Bustan, Seeds of Culture, the Philadelphia nonprofit dedicated to widening understanding, particularly among young people, of Arab culture. And it's been said that writing about music is like dancing about architecture, yet artists in different forms continue to reflect upon one another. Susan Lewis takes a look at the traveling exhibition Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music, now making a summertime stop in New Hope, Pennsylvania. That's all I have this morning. Creatively Speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The American Composers Forum was founded to help support and advocate for the creators of new music. It does this through granting, commissioning, and otherwise supporting the writing and performing of new works. The Composers Forum also provides composers at all stages of their careers with resources for professional and artistic development. By linking communities with composers and performers, the organization helps foster a demand for new music and encourage the development of the next generation of composers, musicians, and of course, music patrons. There are 8 regional American Composers Forum chapters, as well as 3 at academic institutions and an international branch. Among the most active is the Philadelphia chapter, which, as chance would have it, has among its members one of the country's most in-demand contemporary composers in Jennifer Higdon. So when chapter president Jim Jordan came into our studios earlier this week, I first asked him about the Higdon effect.
Given her prominence and popularity, it's kind of trickled down to create more awareness and more interest in the local so-called classical music scene. Jennifer's career has in some ways been a catalyst for building audiences here in Philadelphia.
And in terms of the composers themselves, the fact that she's shown demonstrably that it's possible to be, not really make a living, but to be very, very successful creating classical music, has that been an inspiration to your members, do you think?
In some ways, definitely, particularly with the fact that, you know, Jennifer is of the school of thought that a composer doesn't necessarily need to work with any particular publisher, that she can handle their own publications independent of a publishing company, which is kind of a new, relatively new exercise. I shouldn't say it's actually new, because I think Mendelssohn, in fact, published his own music. But there's been more and more of this occurring in the compositional realm, that is, artists taking control of their own career and publishing their own music and distributing their own music as well.
Besides commissions, which we're very well aware of at the American Composers Forum, indeed the theme music from this program was commissioned by the American
That's
Composers
right.
Forum, what are the other activities that you've been getting involved in the last few years? Some real innovations.
One of our programs that has become extremely popular is called Subito, which is an Italian word, means suddenly or quickly. It's basically a program through which composers and creative musicians may apply for direct project assistance. Anywhere from $500 to $2,000. A composer who has an original musical idea or project, you know, they may apply for this direct assistance and they can see their project to fruition. Many Subito awards have been given to produce recordings of original works. There have been several Subito awards given to assist in participation in music festivals or travel to participate in the premiere of a newly composed work. There have been a number of very successful and very, I think, very compelling community-based residencies involving students working face-to-face with professional composers and professional musicians. And these projects have real lasting impact on the participants.
You've also been getting strongly involved in the use of new technology. There's now a facility whereby your members can reach a wider public with their compositions.
That's very true. www.newmusicphiladelphia.newmusicphiladelphia.com is a streaming webcast, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, commercial free. Anyone with access to the internet may log on.
And what will they find there?
What they'll find there is streaming audio, nonstop, original compositions by Philadelphia artists, most of whom are currently living and working here.
And what form do these performances take? Are these concert performances? Are they
Well, you'll hear live recordings, concert recordings, that is, as well as studio recordings. Many of these studio recordings were actually produced with Subito awards. So you see how the one program area sort of fuels the other. in some ways, the webcast is a new feature, a new program that ACF is offering, which will give a literal forum for composers to have their works heard, as opposed to, you know, ACF existing behind the scenes and working more in a supporting role. The webcast is now giving the composer community, as well as the audiences of this region and beyond, a way of accessing the work of these artists that are living and working here in Philadelphia.
And is there any curatorial role that your chapter is performing?
We aren't looking to exclude music based on its artistic merit or lack thereof, but we are looking to offer this as a service to creative musicians who are, you know, obviously because our name is the Composers Forum, we want original music. We want music that is taking risks, and we want music that is reaching beyond the parameters of acceptable musical culture will allow. We're interested in that. Now, in addition to finding things that are more familiar and more accessible, so the idea is that there is going to be something for everybody on our webcast.
American Composers Forum Philadelphia Chapter President Jim Jordan. And the web address for the chapter's new streaming webcast is newmusicphiladelphia.com.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The theater industry is not known as an especially lucrative business. Away from Broadway and London's West End, there are few millionaire impresarios. But many do make a living from theater. Non-profit professional theaters in the U.S. employ thousands of people who fill artistic, administrative, and technical roles. But how exactly are these jobs and the shows they help produce supported? As part of our continuing series about what it takes to bring theater to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now explores the financing of not-for-profit theater.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
Money, as this song from the musical Cabaret says, indeed makes the world go around. And like it or not, that includes theater arts. It takes money to purchase the rights to a play, build the scenery and costumes, pay the actors, advertise the show, and foot the electric bill or rent. And it seems finding the funding to cover these expenses is becoming more and more challenging for nonprofit theaters.
Honestly, I think it gets harder every year.
Grace Grillet is the managing director of the People's Lights and Theater in Malvern, Pennsylvania. She oversees the $4.9 million operating budget of the Chester County Company. Grillet doesn't gloss over the difficulty of financing her theater, but she also doesn't paint a completely bleak picture.
We just have to be more creative. We try to keep an optimistic outlook, and I feel like that's what other people in these positions do too.
Grillet and any other managing director will tell you that funding for nonprofit theater comes from a variety of sources. In a very broad sense, the income is broken down into two categories, contributed income and earned income. Earned income mainly consists of ticket sales, which for large theaters like People's Light and the Wilma Theater in Philadelphia typically covers about 50% of the operating budget. Jamie Haskins, managing director of the Wilma, which has a $3 million operating budget, says the earned income line is where funding has become most challenging over the last 5 or 6 years, especially when it comes to people purchasing ticket packages for an entire season of plays, the mainstay of a theater's earned income.
Subscription sales have seen precipitous declines, not only here in Philadelphia, but across the nation. It's just a trend attributed to changes in audience behaviors, the internet, you know, what's happening on TV now that you can get 800 channels, whatever it is that's consuming people's free time. It's believed has had some effect on people's willingness to commit to an entire season of plays.
Small to mid-sized theaters, on the other hand, are less reliant on earned income. Combined ticket sales might only account for a third or less of their operating budget. But for any nonprofit theater, large or small, contributed income is crucial. It's made up of support from foundations, local, state, and national government, corporations, sponsorships, and individuals. Here, having a good board of trustees comes in handy, people who have connections and expertise in fundraising. Grace Grillet says there's been a trend in recent years with contributed giving across the country.
Everything that I go to talks about individuals as where the money is coming from, where the contributions are coming from, and that we can't really depend as much on corporations anymore and government. Although I do think that now with a Democratic Congress, maybe the NEA will have more money. And so that's kind of hopeful.
The NEA is the National Endowment for the Arts, a conduit for federal funding. But the local funding scene in the Philadelphia region is very notable, according to Vincent Marini, who earlier this year was the interim executive director of the Theater Alliance of Greater Philadelphia.
I think we're very lucky in Philadelphia in some respects because we have a number of very loyal funders and that really have a national reputation for funding nonprofit theater. Because of that reputation and because of their commitment to nonprofit theater funding, I think that's why you see such a healthy community in Philadelphia.
Home to well over 100 producing theaters, strong local support is one reason there's been a surge of growth in Philadelphia theater over the last decade. But Jamie Haskins notes the growth can also be attributed to a more level playing field here for funding, in contrast to other cities.
There are a number of communities that have what are referred to as flagship theaters, like the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, Seattle Rep in Seattle. I mean, there's one primary theater that stands out as the regional theater of that city. And I think what's unique about Philadelphia is it doesn't have that particular flagship theater, that it has, I think, a really broad and nicely rounded culture of theaters, and that makes the funding, I think, more equal across the board.
By their very definition, nonprofit theaters do not exist to make lots of money. The reason $10 million might be put up to back a for-profit Broadway show is that investors expect to see a significant return. With a profit margin as a priority, it often means playing things safe and sticking with the tried and true formulas. Yet Vincent Marini explains this isn't to say that nonprofit theater is some sort of artistic utopia.
In the end, it's often difficult for nonprofit theatrical organizations because really what nonprofit theaters want to do is produce theater. I mean, that's what the goal really should be. And sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees because you're spending so much time figuring out how you're going to raise the money that it does sometimes seem to dwarf what's happening there artistically.
In fact, the larger regional theaters who have the most resources are the ones who feel the most pressure to satisfy their patrons, those who've loyally supported the theater over the long haul. So for managing directors like Brian Clark of Theater Exile, who works with an annual operating budget of around $200,000, being a small to mid-sized theater has some advantages.
We can do the scripts that we want to do where, you know, some of the larger companies have to cater to their subscribers, their audience base, and, you know, we can be relatively fearless. Now, does that pay a lot of money sometimes? Not necessarily, but being fearless is what we want to do.
Clark explains being fearless, though, doesn't mean doing anything and everything. A successful theater knows their niche and knows how to capitalize on it.
Everybody can't put up Grease. If everybody put up Grease, then the one that's going to win is the one with the bigger budget because we want to go and see the bells and whistles.
A major key to financing theater is striking the right balance. Be daring, but know when to be cautious. Diversify income sources so that if something doesn't come through, the entire season isn't sunk. And with an eye on budgetary constraints, be forward-looking, says Jamie Haskins of the Wilma Theater, continually trying to grow and expand.
We are always striving to ensure that we're looking at what is the next artistic advancement that we can make, because I think if we start treading water, that's when we get into trouble.
While it remains difficult for companies across the board to keep moving forward and find funding, Philadelphia-based theaters continue to find ways to do much more than just tread water.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The genesis of Al Bustan, Seeds of Culture, was in founder Hasami Sayed's desire to give her two young sons an understanding of their Middle Eastern roots. She herself comes from a Lebanese and Egyptian background, but grew up in Kuwait, where she attended the American school. She came to the United States for college and has lived here since. In 2002, she founded a summer camp to teach youngsters from all backgrounds about the Arab language, Arab music, literature, the visual arts, dance, and new media. The camp began at Morris Arboretum, but is now held at the nearby Springside School in Chestnut Hill, where each summer, 6 to 18-year-olds explore Arab culture through a specific related theme. I met with Hasami Sayed earlier this week, and first asked her why Arab culture is so underappreciated by the non-Arab population at large.
It's a heritage that is incredibly rich. The Arab world, I mean, historically, it's an incredibly rich heritage. And contemporary, I mean, the contemporary Arab artists, from the visual to the performing artists to the literary artists, abound. I think it's more a question of what the West, and particularly, say, in America, mainstream media chooses to focus on. And I think whether one actively seeks here to reach out and understand and give coverage and opportunities for Arab artists and Arab American artists to be given a voice within the mainstream media, I think that's often the problem, that there isn't adequate coverage of that.
We're talking about a huge geographic area from Egypt.
22 Arab states.
Right, yeah. And geographically it's a huge sweep. Nationally, it's a huge sweep.
Exactly, and religion-wise, there's there's several religions and many sects within each religion. Yes, I mean, in fact, that's why we feel there's so much to cover, and the way we try to break it down in a more accessible way for young kids is by picking a theme each summer. So this year's theme is Andalusia, the time period from the 9th to the 15th century in southern Spain, and looking at the Arab cultural and scientific legacies of that time period, and then making connections to present-day life. So language is a big part of that, Arabic, and then the connection with Spanish, and then, of course, music is a big part of that, and visual art and the architecture. And we chose, actually, another way to make it kind of more accessible to the young ones. We picked a person, a historical figure by the name of Ziryab, and he's the person that the kids will learn his life story, and from that get a little understanding of that time period.
It was also a time period and a location where Jews and Arabs lived together quite happily.
And Christians, yes, exactly.
It was actually Christians who messed it up, I thought.
Well, by the 15th century, yes. But in fact, exactly. I mean, in fact, there's this idea, the word convivencia in Spanish, which means living together, and in Arabic translated as ta'ayush, of really a sort of an intermingling and a cooperation and exchange across religion, ethnicity, and language. And there were some, you know, particularly in the 9th and 10th centuries, some amazing accomplishments. Both artistic and scientific, and an incredible legacy that still holds with us today, and examples of which, I mean, Ziryab, the figure that we focus on, he's actually probably maybe one of the least known celebrities, in fact, of his time, but and really had great impact on culture of Europe at that time and beyond. He was a freed slave that had spent time as a musician in the court of Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad at the time, and there was some conflict with the head musician there, and was sort of pushed to leave, and ended up traveling and making his way via North Africa, and ended up in Cordoba, where he was very welcomed by the ruler there, Abdurrahman II, and became his court musician, as well as really, he was known to have a beautiful voice. His name is, it's actually a nickname, Ziryab, and it means a black feathered small songbird. And he had a beautiful voice and was known to have added the fifth set of strings to the oud, which is the traditional instrument of Arabic music. And by adding that as well, he had a lot of respect for his accomplishments, and then became really the sort of the minister of culture for the emir, Abdurrahman, at the time. He was the arbiter of taste, style, and manner, and founded a fashion school, really innovated in terms of table manners, and creating the 7-8-course meal where when you say soup to nuts, that's actually his innovation. And he still founded a music school that was open to families of all backgrounds, and also was well known for having been really sort of, in a sense, the Oprah Winfrey of his time, that what he kind of, in terms of his suggestions about fashion and wearing light-colored clothes and linen and whites in the summer to the darker clothes in the winter, and the hair grooming, and were all kind of innovations that he started and was kind of a trendsetter of his time.
What do you want kids to take away from this at the end of the camp?
Well,
he sounds like an ideal role model. He's a fashion leader. He's got great table manners, and he's a very talented artist as well.
Yeah. Well, we want him to certainly think about both that he was an Arab of that time period, but also to make connections to present-day life. I mean, in fact, he was somebody that Córdoba was where he made his home base. He arrived there in 822. That was not his home, but he made it his home and was really, in a sense, you could say maybe he was a foreigner in another land, but really innovated in and contributed to society.
As Sami Sayad, the founder and president of Al Bustan Seeds of Culture, the Philadelphia nonprofit dedicated to widening understanding, particularly among young people, of Arab culture. The group hosts Andalusian Summer Night on Wednesday evening at the Rainey Auditorium at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. The concert features musicians from several ethnic backgrounds and is a celebration of the ancient Andalusian spirit of cultural exchange and cooperation across different religious, national, and linguistic traditions. Most artists are known by their work, painters through their brushstrokes, writers by their words, and composers and musicians through their songs and melodies. But sometimes one art form can shed light on another. An exhibition now at the Michener Museum's New Hope location was created to honour the two passions of George Eastman, the name behind both the Eastman Kodak Company and the Eastman School of Music. It tells a story of American music through photographs, but not just any photographs, as WRTI's Susan Lewis reports.
Can a photograph sing? The traveling exhibition Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music, begins with the premise that photography has something to say about music, or at least those who create and perform it. Conversely, a great musician can infuse a photograph with a certain kind of energy. It was this collaboration between famous musicians and equally accomplished photographers that curator Olivia Mattis was after.
I didn't want someone taking a picture of some star. I really wanted to see the photographers and the musicians on equal footing so that the images would then become an amazing creative dialogue with energy coming out of the image.
Because capturing this creative dialogue drove the collecting, the show documents musical history, but not in a comprehensive way.
I wanted a balance between different genres of music, but I was really guided by the images themselves, and then I put those images where they belonged.
Mattis put each work in a category. Samuel Barber and Leonard Bernstein are in Great American Composers, Miles Davis and Thelonious Monk in Legends of American Jazz. People like Frank Sinatra, Bob Dylan, and Cole Porter are in Icons of American Pop.
And then there's a fourth category called Champions of American Music. And these were basically performers who didn't fit into these other categories. For example, Paul Robeson, the great bass baritone, Marian Anderson, the great contralto, who was also a civil rights pioneer. These were examples of champions of American music.
The 50 photographs span nearly a century, from a 1915 gelatin silver print of John Philip Sousa by Philadelphia portrait photographer Elias Goldensky, to a 2005 portrait of contemporary blues and rock singer Bonnie Raitt by Jeff Dunas. Many of the images are the work of a handful of acclaimed photographers, each of whom had a significant portfolio of musical subjects. Naomi Savage, niece of Man Ray, had made a project in the late 1940s of photographing composers. Philippe Halsman was a staff photographer for Life magazine, as was Annie Leibovitz at Rolling Stone. Art Kane's famous photograph called A Great Day in Harlem turned his career from art direction to photography. Herman Leonard first made a name for himself photographing jazz musicians in the 1940s. He says he'd frequent the clubs, take pictures, and use them to introduce himself.
Photographs were not so prevalent. So when I went in to a club and I did a set, and then I rushed back and I gave them prints, they were very grateful. And then I became welcomed to the set, whereas normally they did not like strange photographers hanging around, which I fully understand, because strange photographers can really be a pain in the neck.
Each photographer had his own approach, says curator Olivia Mattis. Most of Philippe Halsman's photographs were taken in the studio, where he might ask musicians to perform.
Louis Armstrong, Marian Anderson, he would try to provoke that person or get something out of their soul. the other Philip Halsman one was the Joan Baez, where he gets her to shed a tear just by putting her music on the record player.
In contrast, Art Caine did what he called environmental portraits to convey what his subjects meant in American culture. One example is his photo of Sonny and Cher.
He wanted to portray something about California youth culture of the 1960s. So he had them both jump into their swimming pool, and he photographed them fully clothed at the bottom of their pool.
A jazz lover, Herman Leonard was eager to capture the atmosphere in which this uniquely American art form was created. Duke Ellington in a beam of light at the piano. Sonny Stitt with smoke curling like a musical genie around his saxophone. Backstage shots, like those of Billie Holiday and Lena Horne, which Leonard came to enjoy more than those taken in performance.
If I have the privilege of being backstage and listening to this wonderful conversation going on and seeing, you know, how they wipe their brow and whatever they're doing, I find that much more interesting to me than the performance pictures.
This show includes 9 of Leonard's works, including one where Dizzy Gillespie jubilantly hoists his trumpet in the air. Gillespie's daughter, jazz vocalist Jeannie Bryson, says this picture captures her father's essence.
It's very joyous. It's very playful. His body language was so great in it. He was a very physical person. My mom claims that he could squat down like a Russian dancer with one leg out, like in a crouch, and then get back up again. And this has a lot of motion and movement in it, even though, of course, it's a still photograph. It kind of shows you how he moved.
Photographs that show the motion and emotion of music and those who make it were also what Mattis was looking for, as she pored first through the Eastman House collection, then through photos at the studios of the artists or their estates.
For example, Philip Halsman. The ones that I selected for this exhibition included a fabulous image of Louis Armstrong. In that image, you see Louis Armstrong's amazing bug eyes, and you see him playing the trumpet, but you don't see the full trumpet. You just see the mouthpiece, and you see some of the saliva coming down his chin, and you see every pore in his face, and just this energy popping out of that image.
Other photographs include Edward Steichen's images of Irving Berlin and his family, and George Gershwin smoking a cigar. Frances Wolff shows Ornette Coleman playing the violin backwards, an image Mattis says reflects a willingness to take risks.
And this is a perfect example of how American music is about breaking barriers, breaking rules.
While visitors look at the images, a compilation of music created or performed by those represented plays in the gallery. A photography exhibition about music wouldn't be complete without, well, music. Or would it?
That was actually a big question. What music, if any, to play during the show? It's actually quite a thorny problem. In a way, I would prefer to have the show with no music at all, because we all carry our own soundtracks around in our heads.
Can a photograph sing? Maybe not out loud, but for many music lovers, looking at a photograph can be more than a visual experience. If you've heard the music at a club in the 40s or in a state-of-the-art concert hall, on your home record player, or through earbuds connected to the latest technology, the right photograph of a musical master can bring it all back.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Gershwin to Gillespie, Portraits in American Music is at the James A. Michener Art Museum's New Hope location. It runs through October 7th. That's it for now. Our thanks this week to Christine Barbush. Creatively Speaking's American Composers Forum Commission theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.